Great. Well, lovely to be back and to be here with you today. And for any of you who don't know me, I'm Brian Harris. I serve as the principal at Vaux Seminary, where a couple of you have been studying. If you want any more information about the seminary, I've brought along some of the usual kind of flyers, and I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't say it's a fantastic place to study. Come along, enroll, be part of it. It would be great to have you as a student there, and actually it would. Whether you're training for permanent Christian ministry, whether you're training just to be more effective in local church, we try to make sure that in our range of programs there genuinely is something for everyone. Also brought along a couple of books that I've written. I think this one I've mentioned here before, The Tortoise Usually Wins, which is a biblical view of leadership that really focuses on leaders as servants, as stewards, and as shepherds. And I feel fairly passionately about that. So often leadership is about arrogance. It's about being bigger than everyone else. It's about trying to get everyone else to fit in with our agenda. But the biblical view of leadership is always about servant leadership. And this book is written around the theme of what I've called quiet leadership, leadership that's a little less brash, a little more humble, a little bit more follower-focused. And if you're interested in reading up on that or thinking that maybe you can contribute there in some way, because I do believe that more people are leaders than we actually give credit for, then, you know, if this book would help you, that's fantastic. It goes for $14. And then this is another book that I've written, which has only actually been out for a matter of weeks. So I'm fairly excited about it. It's called The Big Picture, and it's about building blocks of a Christian worldview. In other words, what are the things that we actually believe as Christians? And I try to make it very clear that that we shouldn't be too kind of neat or packaged about that. That, in fact, when you think of a Christian worldview, we should think of generous contours, the sort of things which are consistent with a Christian worldview, rather than saying, you know, that's it, we've neatly packaged up the faith in some way. But and I try to explore some of those big areas. And the Paternoster Press, who the printers, thought that a picture to go with it could be little Duplo building blocks, kind of as Duplo blocks can go in a number of different ways. And when you've got the concepts right, when those blocks are in place, you can actually build a myriad of different things with them that can be fantastic and beautiful and can contribute in different ways. So if you're interested in that, it's $2 more, which is a reflection actually on the changing or the depreciation in the dollar, I guess. So this is $16, or you can get them both if you're good at maths, for $30. Do you need that a bit higher? Great. Okay. That's fine, Mummy. Can you actually hear me? Great. Excellent. Okay, but you didn't ask me along to do a whole lot of advertising today. You asked me to speak on James chapter 4, and that's that I certainly plan to do. And I guess when I looked at the chapter, it goes in a number of different ways, and there are lots of different themes that actually spring up from it. But the thing that struck me as maybe being the unifying idea, the unifying thread that comes on through is, so why is it that God so often seems to not answer prayer? And I don't know if you're one of those people who have sometimes said, God just doesn't answer my prayers. Now, if you have said that, the theologian in me would have to say, no, hold on. Wait. That's not true to say. God answers every prayer. It's just that we sometimes struggle to accept that no is an answer, because no is actually sometimes a valid answer to prayer. And in fact, if you're wanting to be reasonably technical about it, you would say God answers every prayer, and there tend to be categories of answers. So God answers some prayers with a yes, and those are completely unproblematic for us. We ask for something, it happens, and we say, fantastic, God answered my prayer. God sometimes answers prayer with a no. We say, God, please give me this, and he says no. And we say, God didn't answer my prayer. No, he said no. And that's another category of answer. Sometimes God says yes, but wait a while. And those can be quite troubling answers. Sometimes as we have to commit something to God, and we just have to leave them with God. And we have to keep on trusting, sometimes in the dark. And then in a season that might be years away, God comes and answers what we actually have been asking for. And sometimes God says yes, but in a completely different way. And so ironically, sometimes our prayers are answered, but they're answered at a level that we didn't necessarily imagine. So we might have been asking at a fairly superficial level, and God finds the actual layer of concern which we're feeling, and he answers at that level. And we may pick that up, or we may not. So just a fairly random kind of example. You might be praying, for example, you might feel very unhappy in your work, and you may be saying, God, please give me another job, please give me another job. And you might not get another job. And yet, you know, when you look back a year later, you may think, you know what, I'm actually no longer so unhappy at work. I feel much more settled here. I feel much more content to actually remain here. Now, did God answer your prayers? You asked for another job. No, he didn't. You're still in the same job. But maybe at a deeper level, he's answered it because you no longer feel quite so restless or whatever. So that would be a fairly technical kind of an answer. But James picks up at a slightly different level. And he says, actually, sometimes we don't get the answers that we're expecting because our desires are not really what they necessarily should be. And so in the opening verses, he asks, as was read to us, what causes fights and quarrels amongst you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You desire but do not have, so you kill. I mean, that's pretty dramatic. This must have been a pretty ruthless kind of a church. I think that most of us sometimes have our quarrels, but usually we leave people alive. James apparently knew some instances where that wasn't the case. You covet, but you cannot get what you want, so you quarrel and fight. You do not have because you do not ask God. Why do you not have? Well, James first answered, you do not have because you do not ask God. When you asked, you do not receive because you asked with the wrong motives. And so he goes on, and as you actually read through this passage, he basically says, so why aren't you getting what it is that you want? Why aren't you getting what it is that you want? Number one, it could be that you simply do not ask. Number two, it could be that when you ask with the wrong motives. Number three, as the passage unpacks, and we'll come to this in just a little while, it could be that you don't realize quite how serious the battle is that you're actually in. You might not realize how big the stakes are. It could be an asking, but you're not really realizing what it is that you're asking or how significant the backdrop actually is. And fourthly, he says, it could be that maybe you're not fully submitted to God and what God is wanting for you. And so those are the four kinds of answers which he gives there. And I thought it could be helpful if we just run through those. And this is the one place that I really enjoy being at because it's the time where I often get interrupted. Most congregations that I go to, people sit there very quietly and they nod off and they, at the end of it say, that was wonderful. And I say, what was wonderful? And they can't tell me, but anyway, it was wonderful apparently. But I always think of Mount Hawthorne's being the place where people ask you questions. If they disagree, they'll tell you. Sometimes they'll do that pleasantly, sometimes not, but anyway, they'll let you know. they have not killed me yet. Could be, but not thus far. So please feel free, and as we go through these, and certainly at the end, I'll give a time for you to throw whatever questions you actually want to ask. So let's start, though, with the first one. So James asked this question, you desire, you do not have, so you kill, you covet, you can't get what you want, so you quarrel and fight. You do not have because you do not ask God. You do not have because you do not ask God. Now, at a certain level, you may say, well, actually, is it possible to take this off for me to hold it? I'm a natural wanderer. There we go. So you do not have because you do not ask God. And I guess the first thing we have to ask is, are we actually asking God for what we want? And that may almost seem like a no-brainer. And often, when we talk about prayer, people say, make sure the prayer isn't just the shopping list. Make sure that when you pray that it isn't just about saying, God, I want this, God, I want that, God, I want the other thing. And yet, at the same time, James over here says, but don't go too far with that. Do remember that sometimes you don't have because you simply are not asking. And it could be that you're not asking because maybe you've been disappointed in the past. Maybe you feel you're not worthy of what it is that you wanted to ask for. Maybe it is because you don't trust God enough. There are all kinds of reasons why we might not actually ask. My mother-in-law turns 98 this year, and she's a wonderful person. And she lives over in South Africa, and when she was in her 80s, she was still able to come and visit us. And whenever she visited us, I learned huge things from her. And I think I learned the most whenever we went shopping. Because whenever we went shopping, it soon became very clear that she could outshine us in shopping just 1,000 times in getting the absolute best deal. And she would do that because whenever she went shopping, she would be very friendly to whoever was selling. And she'd ask them some questions about themselves, and she would take an interest in them. And then she'd say something like, you probably don't realize this, but I'm a pensioner. Actually, there was no risk that the person didn't realize. She was in her 80s and she looked it. But anyway, you probably don't realize, but I'm actually a pensioner. Very difficult to actually come out in a pension nowadays. And she'd just throw in some comments there about the fact that as a pensioner, she was poverty stricken. And And then she'd, you know, thrown the fact that her husband, God bless his soul, had, you know, died a number of years back, but had been a Baptist pastor, and all the great good things that they'd done, because he had been a Baptist pastor, and they had done a number of really great things. What a worthy person she was, and you're a wonderful person. And you just see the price of whatever it was just going down and down and down. And the number of times that people would just say, oh, actually, the business dude, right, I'd love to give this to you, you know. And she... You know, and she'd just look at us afterwards and we'd be amazed. How do you do that? And she'd just say, you just don't ask. You don't ask. No, that's not quite true. You know, I think I'm not sure that I'd get away with the things that she could get away with. But she certainly did teach me that if you're not willing to ask, you don't actually get. And she would boldly go in, and in fairness, it was true. She does actually have very little money, and she couldn't afford many things. But nevertheless, she always got fantastic deals because she was unashamed to actually say, I need this, I can't afford that, can't you make that cheaper? And invariably people would. And sometimes we just don't do that with God. Sometimes for whatever reason, perhaps it is we feel that God is so great, God is so amazing, that we shouldn't bother him with our trivial concerns. And James says, first of all, well, sometimes you're not getting because you're forgetting to ask. And so I just start out by throwing this the very first thing. Could it be that you're not getting your desires because for whatever the reason is, you're not presenting them to God? And strangely, I notice that people almost fall into two categories here. There are some people for whom that is definitely not true. And so some people, when I speak to them, it's very, very clear that whatever they want, they very quickly ask God, almost to the point of extreme selfishness. But other people are sometimes worried because as they talk, it does seem as they almost feel, I'm not worthy, or God wouldn't do this for me, or I'm not special enough. And sometimes people haven't actually thought what it is that they're actually wanting. And James starts out and he actually suggests it's totally appropriate. God is our Father. Ask him. He's willing to give. And if you're not receiving and if you're feeling this perpetual restlessness of why have I not got what I actually want, could it perhaps be that you haven't in the first instance asked? And that's the first thing he puts in place there. Second one, though, he says, when you asked, you don't necessarily have the right motivation behind your asking. You don't necessarily have the right motivation behind your asking. And so if you look at 1 John chapter 5, 14 and 15, for example, he says, and this is the confidence that we have in him, that if we ask anything according to his will, he hears us, and we have the petitions that we desired of him. And likewise, Matthew chapter 6, verse 33 says, but seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. So now in verse 3, James says, when you ask, you do not receive because you ask with wrong motives. And he sometimes says, well, if nothing's happening, just check your motivation behind your asking. Now, C.S. Lewis, who I'm sure that many of you would have read some of his books, he made this fascinating comment that Christians are the true hedonists. Christians are the true hedonists, are the true pleasure lovers. And he said that because he said, you know, by and large, your average hedonist is quite shallow. And we think of someone as being a hedonist, a pleasure seeker, if they simply grab at whatever they actually want. But he says that that's a shallow understanding of hedonism, because hedonism at its root is actually about deeply wanting what will please you the most. And he said that the Christian faith encourages the deepest of hedonists, because in the end it gives us what we most deeply desire and what we most deeply want. And it puts us in a pathway where we don't grab shallowly, but we actually see the longer term benefits of things. And sometimes we might... instinctively, almost immediately say, that's what I want, that's what I want, that's what I want. But said Lewis, when we dig a little deeper, we actually find that we want at a different level altogether. We want that which will most satisfy us over the longer term. And so, a silly kind of example. I don't know if any of you are, like when you're making cakes or whatever, do you enjoy eating the mixture? I actually quite do sometimes. And there's some little... Kids Crunchies, I have a very sweet tooth, and there's this kind of Kids Crunchy mix that we sometimes make at home, and it's filled with sugar and butter and junk and stuff like that, and it's just delicious. And as it gets made, I find that I eat lots of the mixture as it's kind of coming together, far too much. In fact, sometimes there's not that much to bake in the end. And as I go through that, no, that feels great. Until an hour later when I feel absolutely nauseous. And I think, how did I do it? I've done it again. I can't actually believe that I would have been so incredibly stupid. Why? Whereas if they're baked, they're quite nice, and you can kind of have them in reasonable quantities, and you won't feel sick. Now, if you're a true hedonist, you kind of watch these cookies come out, and they last over 3 weeks, and they satisfy, and they're nice, and it's great. If you're a shallow hedonist, you just guzzle the batch straight away, and you feel amazing for 37 seconds, and then an hour later, you feel absolutely awful. And I think that James is saying sometimes you're not actually getting at a deeper level because you're looking shallowly. You're not actually looking from God's perspective. And if you think about it, that really is what Jesus is saying. Seek first God's kingdom. Seek first his righteousness. And all these other things that you tend to put at the top of your agenda, suddenly you'll find that they are being met. Perhaps not in the way that you initially imagined, but they will actually be met. So it's a question of saying, trust God enough. Trust God enough to believe that he has your deepest desires in mind and that he desires that which actually is the best for you. Third thing. As James goes on through, and this maybe it gets a little bit more serious, James starts to suggest, okay, so perhaps you're not getting because you aren't asking. Perhaps you aren't getting because when you ask with the wrong motives, or you ask too shallowly, or you're not really thinking things through deeply enough. But then he says, recognize the battlefield that you're in. Recognize the battlefield that you're in. Verse 1, what causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? Now, I think that's quite significant that James actually initially says, where's the battlefield? And we quite often feel that the battlefield is outside there. And James does address that. He addresses that a little bit further on. So as you come to verse 4, he says this, you adulterous people, don't you know that friendship with the world means enmity against God? Anyone who chooses to be a friend of the world becomes an enemy of God. Or do you think Scripture says without reason that he jealously longs for the Spirit he has caused to dwell in you, but he gives us more grace? And so it goes on and speaks about the world as being a place that sometimes wants to attract us in the wrong kind of a way. But that's not where he actually starts. He starts by saying, identify the desires that battle within you. Identify the shadow within. And realize how deep that battle is actually going to be. And I think that the more I have certainly progressed on in my own journey of faith with Jesus, I realize that, number one, God has stuff that he wants me to do in the world. But in the first instance, God has stuff that he wants to do inside of me. And my agenda tends to always be, you know, what I'd love God to do through me in the world. But as I, in fact, reflect a little bit more deeply within, I realize that that comes from a muddled desire inside of me. And the muddled desire inside of me is because then God can think, wow, you're amazing, you're incredible, I'm deeply dependent upon you, and how would my plan ever actually come off without you? And so we want to be useful to God, and there's nothing wrong with that. But sometimes when we look more deeply within, the motivation behind that can be quite muddled. And so James actually starts to pick up, and he says that if you're really going to get on in becoming the person you most truly want to be, if you want to ask why your desires are not being met, could it be that in the first instance you haven't been willing to start the journey within? The journey of really looking at, so what's the reason behind this? What's motivating me? What's driving me? Are we in tune with the battle that exists? And again, let me almost give another fairly silly example, but sometimes silly examples identify things the most. I've loved being here. Didn't you enjoy that little children's talk there and the interaction with the kids? I was sorry that it didn't carry on a little longer. And maybe that's because I became a grandfather for the first time 2 months ago, so this is my brag period. And so I have a two-month-old granddaughter, Maya Rose, now. And with her, I guess it's kind of got me thinking back to when I have three children, they're all adults now, but thinking to when they were young and some of the things that struck me from that time. And I found that just this week that my mind was wandering back to a time that would have been 20 or so years ago when Jet, my youngest child, he was three, and we were at a church function, and we were playing, it was like a church games evening, and everyone was playing duster hockey together, and people were lined up with people roughly of their age groups and strengths, and Jet was three at the time, and he was wildly in love with a little girl in the church. Samantha was her name. She was also a three-year-old, and they were the number sevens, or whatever the number was, and so when number seven got called out, they had to rush into the middle, they had to try and kind of just knock this little duster hockey thing into the respective goals at the other end. And I can still remember their going for it and, you know, being so delighted. Number seven was called out, and they rush out, and they're three-year-olds, so they feel enormously important to be there. But it soon becomes absolutely clear that they have no idea of what it is that they're supposed to be doing. So they're kind of hitting at this thing, and they're supposed to be getting it in the goal, but they don't quite realize that. So everyone tries to explain to them, you know, you're supposed to get it in the goal because that's the way that you'll win. But then they're stricken because they're wildly in love with each other. And if one of them wins, well, then the other is beaten. So that's not very nice, is it? So they're not quite sure how they should play this game where someone's going to be a winner and someone's going to be a loser. So anyway, they're three-year-olds, so they don't bother about it too much. So they just kind of hit the thing around. And then at one point, Samantha is about to hit the little duster thing into her own goal, which would have meant that Jet was the winner because Samantha didn't really know the rules very well. And so she didn't realize that, in fact, an own goal is not really a very useful thing. At that point, Jet rushes in to stop her from doing that. You know, he would have been the winner if he had done that. And you think, you really don't know what this game is about, do you? But they had enormous fun, and that was great. And that's the lovely thing about three-year-olds. Why am I saying that? I wonder sometimes if, as believers, we forget what the game is about. We forget what the game is about. And we have a great time in this kind of game of being Christians together, and we hit things around, and we together, and we supportive of one another. But James actually paints a fairly serious portrait of the game. And it's of a world that somehow will entrap us. Now, let's be very clear. When the Bible speaks about the world, it speaks about it with two voices. And the one voice that the Bible speaks about the world is a deeply compassionate voice. It's a voice of this is the world that God loves. This is the world God redeems. This is the world that God makes and that God says it's good and it's very good. This is the world that God despairs over when it goes against him. And it's deeply compassionate. The other voice is a voice of real warning. This is a dangerous place. This is a place that could delude you and to set in for something so much less than God actually wants you to be. Be careful of the world. It will trap you. It will encourage you to go for the superficial. It will encourage you to be sinful. And let's remember, we sometimes react against that word sin. But sin in the Bible primarily comes from the Greek word hamartia. And hamartia means to miss the target. So in fact, it's a concept that comes from archery. You know, here's a target over there, and you shoot your arrow at the target, and oops, it lands up over there. Well, you've missed the target altogether. That's sin. And that's the way that sin is most often spoken about in the Bible. Now, it's true that there are sometimes other words that are used for sin, words like adikaya, which means a terrible wickedness, or porneria, from where our word pornography comes from, which is, again, another form of wickedness. But most commonly when the Bible speaks of sin, it simply says hamartia. It's to miss the target. In other words, God has something in mind, and we're not actually attaining it. And that gap is great disappointment and sadness because we're not at all being the people that God wants us to be. And so when the Bible speaks about the world, on the one hand, it's a world, and it's a wonderful place because God made it. And on the other hand, it's a world where it's dangerous and it's threatening, and we could be so much less than we're meant to be, so much less than we're called to be. And we could become terribly evil people. And I guess we only need to listen to the news to realize that the world does always come to us in both of those forms. There are wonderful things that happen day after day after day after day, and there are terrible things. And our capacity for inhumanity towards one another is absolutely stunning. And so James basically is saying over here, sometimes you forget how serious this battle is, because you and I are called to be God's people in God's world. And in the first instance, that means that we must be willing to embark upon this deep inner journey, to look at ourselves, to look at our motivation, to say, God, you know, are we the people that you want us to be? And we do need to be willing to say, God, change me and transform me and make me someone different if that's what you want me to be. And God does call us out into the world to be his agents in the world, to be the world that to make the world more into the place that God has called it to be. And he's saying sometimes you're just like three-year-olds playing duster hockey and you've forgotten, you know, why you were called to the game. Remember, there is actually purpose in the midst of it. And then fourthly, and then I'll throw it open for some questions. He says, and remember, it is important to submit to God in the midst of it. Remember, it is important to submit to God. And let's listen to these verses here from verse 7. And notice how active they are. If any of you are English teachers or interested there, notice all the verbs, all the action words, all the things that we're instructed to do here. Submit yourselves then to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Come near to God, and he will come near to you. Wash your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts, you double-minded. Grieve, mourn, and wail. Change your laughter to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will lift you up. Did you notice all those action things? Submit, resist, come near, wash, purify, grieve, mourn, wail, change, humble yourselves. I mean, that's a lot of things that we're supposed to do. Church where I spent my teenage years, they used to put out a weekly bulletin, and it was in the 70s, and so the language, do any of you remember when it was common in churches to speak about people who are backsliding? People who are backsliding from the Lord, and you've been in that place there? Well, if you went along to the church that I went to, they would have prayed for you, and they put out this little weekly bulletin. And the person who put it together meant to write, you know, please pray for the backsliders in the congregation. And unfortunately, they made a slight little typing error, and it came out as pray for the backsliders in the congregation. And in the 1970s, in that congregation, I assure you, no one laughed when they saw it. Backside in the church bulletin, the language in this place. You know, it was like this huge catastrophe. But anyway, one person was wise enough to say, you know, maybe there's a correlation between the two. Maybe backsiding and backsliding are related in some ways. You know, when we're very passive about our faith and we simply are backsiders as people and don't do anything, maybe that is when we are actually in danger of slipping away from God. And certainly James has a deep sense of activity in this passage. Don't be passive about it. So in your relationship with God, recognize that we are called out into a battleground that sometimes is more serious than we might imagine. And when James says resist the devil, he means resist the devil, because there will be times when you and I will be tempted to be so much less than we're called to be, when we will be tempted to say, actually, this is who God has made you to be. Now settle for your counter self, settle for your shadow self. And sometimes our shadow selves are not way off who we meant to be, but sometimes they're selves that are willing to accept the myths and the lies that people tell us. You know, because of your past, God could never really use you. Because of this, you know, God doesn't actually want you to be involved there. And we settle for that. And sometimes those are deeply demonic. And we feel unworthy. And God actually wants to use us in the world. And James is saying to us, sometimes at your deepest level, you're feeling unfulfilled and unsatisfied. Because it could be that you're just not asking. And it could be that you don't ask because you don't feel worthy enough to receive. Sometimes it could be that you're just wanting the wrong things and you're wanting to be a bit superficial. Sometimes it could be because you don't really realize the depth of the battle that you call to. And sometimes it could be because you don't want to submit to God and actually say, I must actually do this. I must consciously align myself with the battle. One last thing as I close and throw it open for some questions. The passage finishes up in these last little verses here, verse 13. Now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business and make money. Why, you don't even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we'll live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogant schemes. All such boasting is evil. So then, if you know the good you ought to do and don't do it, you sin. Fascinating statement that. If you know the good you ought to do and don't do it, you sin. James doesn't say sinners doing something bad. Somebody says, actually, you know, the positive thing that you should do, and you just passively don't do it. No one can say you did something wrong. James says, actually, that misses the mark. That misses the target. But the backdrop is, he says, actually, the future is God's. I started speaking about my mother-in-law. Let me finish speaking about my mother-in-law. So she would always ask for the special deals, and she always got them. She was also, and she does turn 98 this year, she was also in the generation where whenever she writes anything, whenever she makes any statement, she always adds a little DV after it. Any of you remember the DV? Dio Volente, God willing. You know, if God permits this, if God is okay with this happening. And I guess it's what James actually says to us. You know, we don't know. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen. Live your life with this DV sense. You know, God willing, this will happen. And if God doesn't, well, ultimately God is in control. And I know that we now don't go around and, I mean, when I get my mother's letters and they mother-in-law's letters, and they still are very much letters, you know, these little DVs all over the place, and it looks very quaint and very lovely. But we maybe have lost something. We lose something because we actually sometimes think we're in charge. And James says, remember that ultimately God is God. And when we submit to the fact that God is God, we find our deepest, deepest, deepest peace. And so whatever your deepest desires are, ask God about them, but also put a little DV at the end of it. You know, God knows, and submit that to God, and ultimately trust him for whatever those answers might be. Right, I think I've spoken quite long enough, and very, very open to any questions or comments or disagreements or statements or whatever that you'd like to make. Eggs are preferably not to be thrown.
In that passage in another place in the Bible, they talk about problems in the community. Mm-hmm. People living in individual houses, we may have a problem with a neighbour, but usually our problems these days are in the family.
Yeah. And it is interesting that James locates it as being within the family of the church as well, and begins internally, you know, what calls for fights and quarrels among you, not out there, but actually within the family, that's the church. And I guess that's so often because who are the ones who get close to us? You know, our family and our church family. Very often that is the location, absolutely. So that's hamartia. It's a Greek word. It's the most common. It's not the only word the Bible uses for sin, but it is the one that it most commonly uses. So, for example, when in Romans it says, "For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God," you know, everyone is a sinner. It actually says, "So all have missed the target." And that target is the glory of God. It helps you to understand quite deeply what sin's about. So we often think of sin as being, you know, to say to someone, you're a sinner, you know, we think, how very offensive, and we kind of become all guarded against that. Actually, the Bible's making a very self-evident statement. It says, you know, we have all fallen short of the target, which is to be people having been made in the image of God who somehow reflect what God is like. So what's the target? It's to be image bearers and to reflect what God is like in the world. And Paul in Romans says, but we've all missed that target, and that's our sinfulness. Now it's not the only thing that is called sin in the Bible. You get words like edikaya, for example, which then means, you know, wickedness that is very depraved. But when it talks about the sin that everyone has, it tends to talk about simply hamartia, missing the target. So not everyone is terribly depraved in the sense of, you know, go around slitting everyone's throat or doing that after torturing them for 75 minutes or something. It's not suggesting that. And the Bible doesn't suggest that most people are necessarily those kinds of people. We sometimes think they are. And strictly we sometimes say, you know, sin is sin. It doesn't actually matter. Actually, that's not quite what the Bible says. It does actually differentiate. It is more nuanced than that. Ultimately, all sin falls short of what God is wanting. To be sure, that is actually true. But nevertheless, the Bible does actually say, you know, that there's this category of sin that simply has not been the people that God has called us to be. And then there are some things which are deeply despicable and discussed in every way. Okay. Couple of questions there.
I'm just interested, you stressed in the last part of Jones that it's a very action-focused message. What's your take on the kind of other strand, or one of the other strands in Christian thinking, which is about mysticism and kind of dwelling on things and not necessarily taking always an active position on things?
So it is kind of like these pendulum swings, and sometimes we can have a faith which is, you know, well, it's up to God, and in fact, in my striving, I sometimes become quite sinful, and so let me simply rest back. Now, James, to some extent, finishes in that light with the kind of Deo Volente kind of concept, you know, if God wills it, and remember, it's ultimately up to God. But it's actually this fine point of balance. You know, what causes war amongst you? Well, sometimes it's your desires which rage within. So should there be an inner journey? Absolutely. Should we look introspectively? Absolutely. Should we ask ourselves hard questions? Should we be reflective people? Absolutely. Should it stop there? No, absolutely not. Should it translate into the world? Yes. And so I think that's why James has, in fact, both those elements within there. So on the one hand, look within. At the one hand, you know, recognize that you've got to resign yourself to the will of God. At the same time, get involved, resist the devil, do these things, get into the world of action. So it's not an either or, it's actually deeply a both and, that the spirituality which is embraced. I think that's all. Yep.
Not so much a question, a comment. So going back to that bit about all have sinned, would a modern equivalent be nobody's perfect?
Yeah, it would be nobody's perfect, but I think it would probably be with a... So when we say nobody's perfect, we tend to be very philosophical. I don't think it would be true to say the Bible is quite as laid back about that. I think the Bible is more aspirational. So when we say nobody's perfect, it's like, oh, well, you can't do better than that. When the Bible says you sin, it's actually saying, remember who you've been called to be. You are actually incredible. You are made in the image of God, and you've been made to reflect what God is like. And because you've been made to reflect what God is like, God invites you to be that. You are God's icon in the world. You're God's representative in the world. So never settle for less. So I think it's a fairly vigorous concept. And there is a sense of, there's definitely a sense of deep sadness about that. You know, we've sinned, we've fallen short of what God wants us to be. We should be willing to change. But it's not the sense of you're a worthless worm that we sometimes... I think sometimes when people hear, you know, you're a sinner, they think, oh, you mean I'm a worm, I'm a pathetic nobody. It's not meaning that. Yeah.
That was going to be my comment. I was thinking, what a tragedy. That word, hamartia?
Yeah.
What a tragedy that in my Protestant tradition, it has come to how bad am I, as opposed to God's deepest longing for us is that we become in Him, His image. That's what exactly was my thought. Is a simple idea, is it's aspirational.
Yep.
It's not how bad am I.
Yep, absolutely. So in fact, I feel terribly sad that people feel that it's the wagging finger. It's not. It's the come on, you can be more. God trusts you to be more. God knows who He's made you to be. And you know what? When we fall short, there is forgiveness for us. And there is the love of God that we see in the cross.
Brian, I'm interested in alignment and how it's probably your personal experience of understanding God's will and then aligning yourself with it. I guess that's the challenge for all of us, but what's been your personal experience of being able to do that?
Align with God's will. Do you have 73
years? Or in this context, it's really about... When we are praying, getting that alignment, which is what James is talking about, isn't it?
And I would have to say that there have been times when I have deeply known what God is wanting me to do, and I've known it because it's been not necessarily a lightning bolt, but because something deep within just helps you to know, well, this is what you must do, and that's ranged from our major moves. So I grew up in South Africa, and you know, because God, I say it without any any hesitation, saying that God guided us to go to New Zealand, and I could tell you the story, and it was quite miraculous, and I knew that that was right. God also guided us to come to Australia, and I could tell you, and it was fairly miraculous. Now, I'm not going to say that that's how most of my days are spent, so I view those as a few really huge experiences in my life. I've just known that that's been what God has been telling me to do. But sometimes it's been more simple things. I can remember once when my oldest son, Nick, was a teenager, and he'd just been going through this, I mean, you know, teenagers are like just a difficult period, and felt like the home was this nightmare battle zone the whole time. It was very draining, and I just thought, you know, what's happened to this great relationship that we used to have? And he had done something in particular, and that he was clearly out of line. There was no question about it. And I thought, oh, I'm going to have to confront him about this, and there's going to be another huge argument. It's just going to be so ugly, and it's going to be terrible. And I can remember, and I was actually at a church prayer meeting, and in that prayer meeting, God said, just put a chocolate on his bed and say, sometimes you get what you don't deserve. And it was, I don't know where it came, it was just like a deep sense that God said, just do that, which I did. And it was a transforming moment. You know, I mean, he knew it was wrong. He expected this big explosion. He got a chocolate. Sometimes you get what you don't expect. We were able to speak about it. I think it was just wisdom that came from God at that particular moment. So sometimes it's for big things, sometimes for smaller things. Most often, you've just got to live your life just trusting that what you're doing is right, and which is where I think that personal review and reflection can become really important. So I live my life trying to say, Lord, I'll go back over the day reasonably regularly. Is this right? Is this wrong? Do I need to be changing? And then you've just got to trust what comes. So I don't want any of those examples to give you the impression that every single thing I do it with a sense of, this is definitely what God said. That no, it isn't. I mean, like all of us, most of the time I just go around saying, I'm trying to be in God's will. I've got to trust what comes. I don't know if that's some kind of an answer.
Yeah,